Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Dr. Jamil Battle. Welcome, Jamil. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah, I heard you were out sailing or cruising or one of these things.
I certainly was. Jazz cruise. Blue Note jazz cruise.
Oh, my God. Are you going to sing something for us later today?
I might.
Okay. We're looking forward. Well, we're also looking forward to talking today with a great guest, neurologist Dr. Nauman Tariq, director of the Headache Center, Johns Hopkins, about when your head starts to pound unusual headache disorders. And boy, from those headaches that I think I get, everyone gets, to those things you worry about, to those things that you should worry about, those are the kind of things we're going to probably talk about.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating to get the expert opinion on this.
Yep. But first, we're going to have some research that matters. And let's dive right into the very first one, which is about electronic cigarettes and a higher risk of stroke. An interesting area, because we've heard a lot about electronic cigarettes recently, and I've done a lot of research on electronic cigarettes, and most recently it was about kind of their use and utility in smoking cessation for getting people from combustible cigarettes to e-cigarettes and some positive outcomes of getting them off that, but most of, not all of them, were actually still using electronic cigarettes. This study would be of interest to them, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. And because of the surge in popularity with e-cigarettes and the belief that they're safe or safer alternatives, this study actually shows the opposite.
It showed calls for concern, right, at least. And what was interesting is, because there's so little data about longer-term health outcomes, this was looking at over 400,000 people who participated in an ongoing behavioral risk surveillance phone survey in all 50 states. And this was actually in 2016, so this mass increase in electronic cigarettes probably hadn't occurred, certainly not with the youth. And almost 65,000 reported using e-cigarettes at least once. And compared to those who didn't use e-cigarettes, those who used them had a much higher risk of stroke, 71%, 59% higher risk of heart attack, and 40% higher risk of heart disease. Now, that included those who were dual users, but when they only looked at the e-cigarette users alone, it was still high, wasn't it?
It certainly was. So looking at e-cigarette use alone and comparing to non-smokers, even with that group, there was a 29% higher risk of stroke and a 25% higher risk of heart attack.
Yeah, so that would be really cause for concern. In addition to which, looking again at the dual users, there are some who feel that that dual use could be worse than any use of anyone alone by themselves, and certainly may not have a health benefit. So I think this is one of the first research studies that really begins to tease out looking at those who are just e-cigarette users, potentially some of us. It doesn't say it's causing the issue. We need a different type of study, but it certainly kind of debunks this notion that some may have that e-cigarettes are completely safe.
And certainly with this association, it definitely, I think, adds that we need to track health over time and get a clearer picture, but certainly doesn't look like it's a safer alternative.
Let's talk about our next research that matter is about kind of looking forward. Does it really matter if you were to try to set up a sexually transmitted disease testing among gay men to test for preventable or treatable health conditions like gonorrhea or syphilis or even HIV, is there different ways that you may go about not only testing them that increases testing, but also things you could say to them? What are they talking about here?
Well, it looks like this was a study done by researchers at UNC Chapel Hill, the UNC Project China site.
We like that.
Yes, we do. And what they did is they offered screening for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and then asked them to donate to the testing of another man. And it looked
like that was the intervention conditions.
Yes.
They called it a pay it forward group. Mm-hmm. That if you contribute some money to your test, we'll use that money to help get other people tested. That pay it forward versus the traditional group where they just gave them the money
right.
to get tested.
To get tested, that's right. So that would be called the standard of care group. And they found that 48% were more likely to get tested in the pay it forward model.
And these people also donated some money. So I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And only 6% of people in the standard group agreed to be screened versus 54% opted to be tested in the pay it forward group. What was it about the pay it forward that got them to agree to be tested that was so much greater just with this idea of they're going to give a little bit of money and it's going to help someone else, so therefore they agree to get tested?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like they were trying to understand why and didn't really answer that question, but basically the model shows that maybe this is a promising strategy for a sustainable program for STD screening.
You know, it's really interesting. I wonder how much this research would play into other things. So you come in and get treated for, let's say, your weight in a weight management program, and you ask someone that, you know, we know that you're going to get a bill for $25. Maybe it costs $30. And, you know, would you be willing to give $10 to help those that can't afford it, you know, and add on, you know, give people the opportunity to do things that help others. That's the main takeaway I get, that people really do want to help others and giving them some opportunities. I'm sure there's some ethical problems with that. I know we have a guest on some show soon that'll talk about kind of those ethical issues, but I do like the idea.
I do too.
Let's talk about our next research that I like the idea. And this is about what is the impact of setting attainable goals on health outcomes. And I know this is right up your alley from some of the work that's near and dear to you about your life.
Well, it definitely shows. This was done, let's see, published in European Journal of Personality.
Ooh, that sounds like a high-flight journal. I kind of like that.
Right. And it looks like they were looking at German-speaking parts of Switzerland. And it sounds like their question was, basically, if you set realistic goals for higher level well-being, would you later have life satisfaction and would you be more satisfied with your life? And it sounds like they used this data from 973 people between ages of 18 and 92 years of age. And they asked them for the importance of life goals in 10 different areas.
Like health, community, personal growth, social relationships, fame, image, wealth, family responsibility, yeah. care for younger generations, and work. Mm-hmm. I've never really thought about that. You know, what are, you know, you think about your life goals, you think about it kind of career-wise, maybe family-wise. These are 10 concrete areas, and they found that the more you were likely to do that and the more you perceive that those goals are attainable, this actually, it was an indicator for feeling healthier and thinking that you're healthier later on. It gave you some control and attainability. Like if you said, I want to be president of the United States, those aren't necessarily attainable for even the best and the brightest. But other goals, like I would like to write a book about my childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It definitely shows, I think, with an indicator for a later cognitive and affective well-being. And I can personally attest to that as I have written a book about childhood experiences. And I think also what's interesting is the link between these goals and age. And they show that link was independent of age. But younger people wanted status and older people social engagement.
So what am I? I want a little bit of status, but I want a lot of social engagement. I guess I'm getting older.
You're getting older, Adam.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with neurologist Dr. Nauman Tariq, director of the Headache Center Johns Hopkins, about when your head starts to pound, unusual headache disorders. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with neurologist Dr. Nauman Tariq, director of the Headache Center at Johns Hopkins University, about when your head starts to pound, unusual headache disorders. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Tariq.
All right. Thank you for having me on my show.
We know it's good. Well, you can have the show. We'll share. It's actually great to have you, and I think we like this intimacy. So feel free to join us. And I guess we'd love to start out hearing a little bit more about yourself. How did you get interested in medicine and neurology and headaches?
Sure. Yeah, so for me, I always was inspired by neurology. I mean, everything about the brain fascinated me. So that's what I chose in medical school. And then during my residency in neurology, around my third year, I noticed that a lot of these headache patients, we had a headache specialist at my residency program who would only run a headache clinic for half day out of the whole week. And there was a waiting list to see him, and that would be for months long of waiting list. So, and then I had a few patients who we weren't really exactly able to help them out much. So then that raised my curiosity in headaches, and I decided to do an elective at Thomas Jefferson Hospital under Dr. Silberstein. And just within 2 weeks, just a few months before my graduation, I decided that I'm doing headache medicine. The thing that struck me the most was a lot of patients had so much gratitude for, you know, the way they were helped, especially in their younger years. And the thing that fascinated me the most was that some of these patients, you know, in their 60s and 70s would just come once a year or once every 6 months just to be obliged because the doctor helped them when they were young. So that's something that's really inspired me, and I decided I'm going to do headache medicine. Plus, as you know, there's a national shortage of headache doctors in the country. In some places, there's a 7-month wait list to see a headache specialist. So also I felt that there was a gap there that I could grow in this specialty.
Yeah, we're so glad that you chose that because it's so needed.
Well, we've all had a headache. I can recall having NSAID-induced headaches. And I was curious about NSAID-induced headaches and maybe some other types that are unusual presentations or headaches.
And we should define what NSAID is. What are you talking about here?
So the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
The things like ibuprofen and Meprin and Nuprin and aspirin and down south, goody powders.
So, you know, back in 1960s, there was a paper that was published and it alluded to this phenomena that NSAIDs could induce a headache rather than treating them. If used frequently, they could result in headache. And people ignored it, and it was just basically under the layers for another 25 years until the late 1980s when this topic was again picked up and NSAID use, I mean, over-the-counter NSAIDs and all those things became very prevalent. And then studies started to come out, you know, coming up with a link that patients who were using at least 15 days or more per month of these NSAIDs for 3 consecutive months, they were at a high risk of developing NSAID-induced headaches. And this phenomenon was solely in migraine patients. So then there was a couple of functional MRI studies which showed that there were some changes in the cortex, which is part of the brain, that was induced by using these NSAIDs, patients who were using it very frequently for 3 months or more. And then when they would stop using these NSAIDs, then after 6 months, you know, the changes of the brain would basically go away and patients would go back to their pre-NSAID use anatomy, just to kind of simplify all that. However, recently in the last couple of years, this topic has become a little controversial because, you know, as we see in our practice, there's a lot of elderly patients, typically elderly, who are on daily aspirin for, you know, stroke prevention, heart prevention, and, you know, some of them are migraineurs, but they do not get into this NSAID-induced daily headache. So really, when you go to these headache society meetings, there are really two groups there, one who highly support this notion that, you know, the NSAID-induced headaches, they do actually exist, and, you know, they're very prevalent, and they give the evidence that when you ask patients to stop those medicines, and after 2-3 months, their headache naturally get better. The other side, you know, this argument which I just said that, you know, a lot of patients with heart disease or stroke are on NSAIDs like aspirin on a daily basis, but they do not get an NSAID-induced headache. If you ask my personal opinion, I believe that there is a correlation there, because in my personal experience, you know, patients who have used NSAIDs, especially the combination ones, the ones that are available in the form of aspirin, acetaminophen, and caffeine, those combination over-the-counter tablets, it's highly prevalent in those patients. And when I ask them to stop those medicines, they do come back for a follow-up after 2-3 months, and their headache are usually better.
Isn't that interesting that sometimes in order to get better, you got to stop what perhaps the doctor prescribed or what you did? Though that's not that unusual, right? I mean, if we think about many things in medicine, we start a medicine and whatever the problem was originally, it may not be the same and they have a side effect. And but here, the headache that they had may be worse by something that's used oftentimes successfully intermittently to treat a headache. Fascinating.
Yes, yes, that's true. So migraine patients sometimes become desperate, and they have their jobs, their family lives, the events they need to attend, and then it's like a shortcut where they go and buy these over-the-counter medicines and then tend to overuse them. And then they go into this cycle of, the vicious cycle of, you know, the medicine rather than treating the headaches that starts to cause headaches.
So if we think about kind of headaches in general, we think about this idea of unusual headache disorders. What's something else that you see that, you know, maybe it's not uncommon, but it may be unusual and people don't think about it? Their primary care doctor may not think about this as a cause of their headache. They may say it's muscle tension, but it may be this. What do you see? And maybe an example of a patient that you've seen it in.
So, migraine is approximately 80% of our practice here at the headache center. However, we do see some rare headache syndromes like primary stabbing headache or even cluster is not that prevalent, the cluster headaches. It's like 0.04% to 0.06% of the U.S. population. Sometimes we see patients with hemicrania continua, which is also a very rare headache, which is a one-sided headache with a lot of tearing of the eyes, nasal congestion on one side, ear fullness, and that just goes on 24/7. Sometimes we see patients with an underlying headache without any clear characteristics, and we scan the patient and turns out to be a brain tumor. We do see patients who have radiation to their head and neck for head and neck cancers, and then they develop these headache syndromes after they get the radiotherapy. In fact, there's one patient I saw who had a cardiac transplant and 2 months later developed this new onset headache, which he never had before. So yeah, we do see, off and on here and there, interesting cases, unusual cases.
And, you know, one of the things I know you have an interest in, and we can pick up afterwards, but I'd love to hear kind of how you got interested in what's called post-traumatic headaches. Because is that a fancy term for muscle tension headaches? That doesn't seem to be the same thing.
So there is a difference there. The muscle tension headaches typically are patients describe to us that they have a feeling of a band around their head. They do have muscle stiffness and tension, but they typically do not have nausea. That's really the differentiating landmark symptom between a tension type or a muscle tension type headache and a migraine. And for post-traumatic headaches, it's a generalized term. We can divide it into mild traumatic brain injury, moderate or severe traumatic brain injury. So post-traumatic headaches is sort of like an umbrella diagnosis which covers all these three mild, moderate, and severe forms of traumatic brain injury. The mild TBI in general is called concussion, which we hear a lot, you know, in the last few years. So patients who typically have a history of migraine, they are more prone to having long-term consequences of having a concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury. And those are the patients who eventually need some prophylactic or daily use medicines down the road.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And when we return, we will continue to talk about unusual headache syndromes. But first, we need to take a short break. And when we return, we'll continue talking with neurologist Dr. Tariq, director of the Headache Center at Johns Hopkins, about when your head starts to pound and unusual headaches.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with neurologist Dr. Nauman Tariq, director of the Headache Center, Johns Hopkins, about when your head starts to pound, unusual headache disorders. And before the break, Dr. Tariq, you were kind of leading us on a path to some things that were usual, but perhaps people aren't aware of, to very unusual. And it leads me to wonder, how important is it to actually make the diagnosis, or how often do people get the wrong diagnosis? And how do you talk about that with patients?
Yes, Adam, so that's an interesting question you brought up. I see that very often here in our headache center that patients have been misdiagnosed as a tension type headache, and it turns out to be a migraine. In fact, this morning, the patient I saw was in her 40s, and all these years she was told she had tension type headache. And when I went through the criteria for migraine, she had this surprised look on her face. And not just that, I do see quite a few patients who have been diagnosed as a quote-unquote sinus headaches, which eventually turns out to be a migraine, because migraine varies in presentations in the population, and sometimes it can present as nasal congestion or some sinus symptoms, which actually part of the migraine syndrome. As you know, a migraine can involve what we call these autonomic pathways. I mean, if you look at, in a general sense, all these allergy reactions are body's own response to a foreign antigen, pollen or, other things. So body can develop a response by itself. And this is exactly what happens in migraine in up to 10-15% of patients, where the body has its own intrinsic response, which turns out to be an allergic response, but actually it's part of the migraine syndrome. So I see these patients who have had antibiotics for years from ENT doctors, from primary care doctors, and once we start them on a migraine program, they're these nasal congestion symptoms start to get better.
Fascinating.
Have you seen the presentation of trigeminal neuralgia be misdiagnosed? And when you get those kind of cases, how do you manage that? Because I know that was common in primary care with my maybe chronic pain or my female patients or patients under a lot of stress. And I wondered if you get some cases that are misdiagnosed that are trigeminal neuralgia and what that is.
Yeah, and tell us what it is.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So trigeminal nerve is a very big nerve out of those 12 nerves we have that come out of the brain. So it has, as you know, three nucleuses, and one of the subset of this trigeminal nerve nucleus, it supplies the sensory nerves to the face. So trigeminal neuralgia is distinct because, first of all, the treatments are completely different. If they're misdiagnosed as migraine or tension type headache or some atypical facial pain, those treatments are not going to work. So trigeminal neuralgia is a type of a face pain, which is a sharp shooting electric pain that has to respect the time interval. That's very important because this pain lasts for a few seconds to 2 minutes, especially the sharp spikes. There might be a baseline background pain there that is constant 24/7 on one side, but the patient has to have a few seconds to 2 minutes of sharp electric stabbing pain, most commonly radiating from his or her ear to the jawline or to the upper teeth. Because there's only 5% of trigeminal neuralgias would radiate to around close to the eye. In fact, most of these migraine patients have pain behind the eye feeling, which actually is part of migraine rather than trigeminal neuralgia. So this is the peculiar pain they have. And also trigeminal neuralgia patients, their pain is triggered by touch, by brushing their teeth, by applying moisture or shaving cream on their face, even by cold wind, which rarely happens in other types of face pains or headaches. So that's another distinguishing feature of trigeminal neuralgia, that this is triggered by just any stimulus as simple as a touch to the face. As I mentioned, the treatments are completely different for trigeminal neuralgia. It's important to diagnose that the first time, because patients will suffer before they get the correct diagnosis. With regards to treatments, we typically use anti-seizure class of drugs for trigeminal neuralgia, like carbamazepine, oxcarbamazepine, which blocks sodium channels. And then the next step is muscle relaxants. If that fails, then you know we recommend gamma knife radiation surgery, or sometimes even blocks, which include bupivacaine, which is a local anesthetic, directly into the trigeminal nerve. But first of all, when patients are suspected to have trigeminal neuralgia, they always should have an MRI of the brain, because around half of the patients might have some compression of this trigeminal nerve, and the artery would be pulsating and compressing and constantly irritating that trigeminal nerve. And that's a surgically correctable problem. And the five-year outcomes are amazing, actually. Approximately 80% are pain-free if we are able to find that compression in the trigeminal nerve and able to put a little separation there so that it does not keep irritating the nerve.
You know, it's really interesting because you begin to see the complexity of the headache and why someone who really specializes and understands this is so critical. One of the things I was curious about, I had a couple patients recently who kind of volunteered, maybe I elicited, but, you know, talking to them about, you know, do you drink much alcohol? And they say, no, but every time I drink alcohol, I get a headache. And it's not like that they're drinking 2 and 3 glasses of wine in an hour and then they get it. But virtually every time they wake up in the middle of the night with a headache after having had a beer or a glass of wine or a mixed drink. What's that about? What do we know about the impact of alcohol and headaches?
Sure. So alcohol dilates or expands the arteries in the brain. And in migraine-type headaches, the dilation or expansion of the arteries of the brain is one of the processes during the headache propagation. So I personally think that there is likely this common link between alcohol expanding the arteries of the brain and causing a headache, similarly as how the migraine, one of the processes of migraine, it happens. That's really the only, you know, common link I can come up with why alcohol causes headaches in a lot of patients. I do know that alcohol is a very common trigger for patients who have a pre-existing history of migraine. They are more prone to having alcohol-related headaches than patients who do not have a migraine at all.
And are there any headaches that maybe we should take more seriously?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So headaches that are daily, even though they fulfill the criteria for migraine, which is light sensitivity, nausea, throbbing, pounding headache, they should always be taken seriously. Whenever a patient comes up with a daily headache, although it's a textbook migraine, we always should image them. So that's one point. The second is patients having what they say a thunderclap headache, the quote-unquote worst headache of their life. We should always do a head imaging because we want to make sure there is no brain aneurysm, which is an outpouching or a weak part of the artery that can rupture and cause a brain hemorrhage. And patients who develop sudden weakness or sudden vision symptoms for their headache, they should always be scanned as well.
Yeah, I've had unfortunately too many experiences with some of my patients who have brain cancer, even though rare, something happens and it's there. You know, last question is, what do we know and are you concerned about kind of the data and of people who are perhaps using their cell phone, their devices all the time and get headaches from kind of screen and even that relationship with cancer? Do you think that that's a problem?
Yes. So actually, that's a good question you asked because I did become interested in this whole thing. And, you know, these are not ionizing radiations from the cell phone. However, these are similar to the microwave radiations, you know, the food we cook in the microwaves. And, you know, there was a study I looked at a couple of years ago in which they exposed mice to cell phone radiation or cell phone waves, and the mice who were exposed to higher times with this particular cell phone radiation, they actually had a higher incidence of tumors, not necessarily brain tumors, but other tumors as compared to mice who were not exposed to this cell phone radiation, similar to microwave radiation. So I'm a bit cautious that I suspect that there could possibly be some link with hours and hours of cell phone use and possibly causing some kind of a molecular or micro level change. Again, we need bigger, larger studies to prove that.
Well, we appreciate you, Dr. Namantari, Director of the Headache Center at Johns Hopkins, and appreciate you being a guest with us today on Your Health and talking in, I would call, very empathetic and compassionate tones about things that are common but also rare and that sometimes could be life-threatening and that really concern people. So thank you so much for sharing all of that with Your Health listeners.
You're welcome, Adam and Jamila. Thank you for having me on your show.
We've been talking with neurologist Dr. Nauman Tariq, director of the Headache Center, Johns Hopkins, about what happens when your headache starts to pound and unusual headache disorders. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Jamila, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth, one word, at unc.edu. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I recently discovered that my doctor's office closed. I didn't receive any notification about this, and I have no idea where my medical records went. Do you have any advice for how I should go about finding a new doctor and how I can get that new doctor my records?
Yes.
Something's happening here, and it's strange. What was the movie Ghostbusters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that feels like this is a Ghostbusters type of moment.
A mystery,
yeah. You know, I'll tell you one story. I'm sure it has nothing to do with this particular story, but I was unfortunately someone who I knew a long, long, long time ago, and I was traveling. I wasn't far from their office. I thought, I'd call and just check on this person, a colleague, and their office number kept going into a cycle, and you couldn't get an answer. It was in the middle of the day. I was like, this doesn't sound right. Something's wrong here. And so I looked up on the news, and this person had been arrested. The person I used to know had been arrested for selling opiates. And this was like 30 years ago. And I'm like, I was so upset for so many reasons. Something bad had happened there. And I'm not saying that's what happened here. Right. Most likely, the person closed their practice for reasons that they couldn't afford. But it seems awfully strange that they didn't communicate to their patients. Have you heard of such a thing?
Well, I've heard of it, but when there's lack of communication, that's a fine line between lack of communication and abandonment.
Right, and abandonment is actually against the medical board. You really can't do that. You have to let them know where they can get their records and ensure a transition because some of these patients may have serious medical problems.
Right.
I think I would say probably contact a medical board to report it and ask your friends, get in to see someone else really quickly who you trust. And it sounds like you had some trust here. I'm so sorry to hear this. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I recently saw my doctor for chest pain and they did an EKG. Everything looked fine except that I had a long QT interval. The doctor said this could cause sudden death and told me to talk to my therapist about a psychiatric medication that I take. I almost panicked, and I wondered whether I should just totally stop that medicine.
Oy. We've gone from the frying pan into the fire here. This is a tough situation. I tell you, doctors need to be aware of it. They need to test for it and look for it, and they need to be able to manage this appropriately. It's common and potentially very serious.
And, I would caution stopping medication just suddenly as well.
Yeah. No, you don't want to stop it suddenly unless you were having some sort of abnormal effect from this. So what we're talking about is a lengthened, when your heart beats, a single beat, you can look at this on an EKG, an electrocardiogram, and see this the rhythm of that beat. And that length of that beat, there's a certain segment within that beat. It's called a QT interval. And basically, if that gets longer and longer, then your beat may get longer and longer, and then that beat may become abnormal. And you may have something called torsades or ventricular fibrillation. And basically, that could be terminal, and it could kill you quickly and sudden death. So you do want to talk with your psychiatric, and some of the psychiatric medications, Haldol, Seroquel, others can do this, pretty notorious, and you probably do need to work with your therapist on getting a lower dose and or switching if indeed that doesn't change it.
Sounds like wise advice.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
The next house call is, recently my mother was in to see her doctor for her yearly physical, and she relayed to them how difficult it has been to get messages to the doctor. The doctor mentioned a new program called Chronic Care Management, and shortly thereafter, a nurse who runs the program came in. She said that she would call my mother monthly and that my mother could also call her if she needs anything. I've never heard of this program. Is it too good to be true?
No, I don't think it's too good to be true, but it sure is good and it sure is true.
But what if I want to talk to my doctor?
Yeah, you know, the nice thing about this program is you certainly can use the traditional channels, but we know if you send a message into a doctor and you're one of like 25 people who sent that message in that day, you may be the 25th one with the answer, and it could be the first one. But you get a message into this nurse, and you've already been identified potentially as higher risk. That's why they have this program, is to help people with multiple chronic conditions get better management. That nurse can come over to me, comes over to me a couple times a day in my office and says, hey, Adam, you know, let's say Laura Lacey, not my patient, but let's use that name for a thing, needs to talk with you, is having this problem. Would you like me to call them back? Would you like to see them? Would you like to call back? And it's like, oh, wow, you know, and I have an extra pair of hands, an extra pair of ears and eyes. It's great. I want that kind of care when I have chronic medical problems.
And I think having an extra pair of eyes is better than one pair.
Yeah, it's like two pairs of eyes, two pairs of ears. And they'll call regularly, and you can call them. And it really, in Medicare and private insurance, actually are increasingly paying for this. It really doesn't cost patients anything. I think it's the wave of the future, which is to say, you know what? A lot of care doesn't have to happen in the exam room. It can happen in your home with your telephone. Thank you so much for that great question. Ask your doctor, do they participate in this chronic care management program, and how do you get involved if you've got some chronic health conditions? Or what's our very last house call?
My father was having some memory problems, and after seeing the doctor, we were told that he has vascular dementia. What's the difference between that and Alzheimer's?
Great question. And I used to wonder myself at times, and then I had a relative have vascular dementia, so I got to read a lot more about it and know that it's actually a different beast than Alzheimer's. Though a lot of people with Alzheimer's might have vascular dementia, and some people with vascular dementia might have Alzheimer's. What is vascular dementia, Jamila?
Well, it's when we have risk factors for cardiovascular disease, stroke, and we have plugging of the arteries, inflammation in the arteries. And essentially, it's that mechanism that causes the symptoms of dementia. And so treatment would focus on reducing your risk factors for cardiovascular disease and stroke, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And we do know increasingly that some of those same risk factors may cause inflammation that relates to Alzheimer's. The treatment for Alzheimer's, though, is some of these medicines that can maybe help preserve memory. And so some of the people will have both. And so you may find that those medicines that people have this vascular dementia from high blood pressure may benefit from those medicines, but really need to get their blood pressure low. And the Alzheimer's patients may benefit from those medicines, but also need to get their blood pressure lower. Sometimes I see a difference that the vascular dementia doesn't get as bad as quickly. They're able to preserve function longer than some of the Alzheimer patients. But boy, they're both tough. No one likes to hear that word dementia.
No way.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. We want to thank all of our listeners for sending us great questions, and we hope you've enjoyed our conversations today. We want to thank all of you for joining us for Your Health. If you want to send us any questions or stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle, and our guest today, Dr. Nauman Tariq. We hope you join us next time for Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.